Allen Fashion, 60 feet.
Good morning. Court's ready to hear argument in Chadwick versus Kennedy.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, David Ferry, representing the petitioner appellant June Moses. I'd like to reserve between 2 and 5 minutes for rebuttal if time permits. Petitioner June Moses filed a guardianship petition for her grandmother in the Court of Chancery on June 28, 2000. Because of concerns for her safety and possible exploitation by her son, who is the petitioner's uncle, John Kennedy. At the time, Mrs. Chadwick was 90 years of age. She was living alone in her home in Newcastle, just a couple of blocks away from her granddaughter, who had enjoyed a very good mother-daughter type relationship with her for many, many years. The court appointed, in the preliminary order, an attorney ad litem who had previously represented Mrs. Chadwick. He interviewed her and he agreed that a guardian of the property should be appointed to properly handle her affairs. Thereafter, a very fierce defense was made to the petition by Mr. Kennedy, the uncle, the son of the disabled person, and by Mrs. Chadwick herself, who hired counsel with the assistance of her son. The parties engaged in a very significant battle with multiple depositions and motions and hearings, which culminated in a 3-day trial before then Vice Chancellor Jacobs, and eventually an agreement appointing a neutral guardian of the property was entered on the record on May 23 of 2003. That was something that appointed a neutral guardian. It was something the petitioner had been agreeable to for nearly 3 years prior to that date. Even after that agreement was entered on the record, there continued to be a battle from the disabled person's counsel and the son's counsel about the terms of the final order, such that the actual final order was not signed by the new vice chancellor assigned to the case, Vice Chancellor Noble, until December 17 of 03. The agreement in order of May 23, 03, and of course the subsequent order signed December 17, 03, allowed for the filing of fee applications after the entry of the final order, as is the custom and the practice in guardianship matters in the Court of Chancery. That application of petitioner June Moses is the subject of this appeal. Her application was for fees and costs of approximately $51,000, of which approximately $47,500 were fees and the balance were costs.
Now, the record reflects Mrs. Chadwick also died on December 17th, is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. The same day the final order was signed, December 17, 03, nearly 7 months after the agreement was reached, Mrs. Chadwick passed away.
And does the record reflect, I know there was this fee dispute, the ultimate disposition of her estate?
I know what the ultimate disposition of her estate is. Whether that's in the record of this case, I'm not 100% certain. There was a will. The will was admitted to probate. That will leaves the entire estate to respondent John Kennedy, and he was ultimately appointed representative of the estate. There was discussion in the record at the hearing before Vice Chancellor Noble on June 8, 2004, that at that time no representative had been appointed and one would need to be appointed before the funds that were being escrowed by the court would be released. And he wasn't.
So that's what's in the record purported to be a holographic will, although it's the will that was dictated to Mr. Kennedy?
It is not. The will that was admitted to probate is a will that was prepared and executed in November of 2002, and that's the will that's on file and admitted to probate in Maryland. As the court's aware, at the hearing on June 8th...
While we're going into things that aren't on the record, is the estate being contested? Is the will being contested? Is there litigation?
The short answer to that, Your Honor, is no. As far as the record goes, I'm just not 100% certain if the admission of the November 2002 record will is in the record or not. It may be. I'm just not certain. But I do know that will, November 2002, was admitted to probate. Mr. Kennedy has been appointed representative, and there has not been a contest filed to that will.
Thank you.
The argument, of course, that is made in this matter is that the court abused its discretion by reducing the petitioner's fee and cost application by approximately 90%. The three arguments that are made by petitioner in support of her appeal to this court is that the trial judge applied a benefit analysis which produced an unjust result. I think the trial judge primarily came to the conclusion that because a guardianship lasted for a very short period of time, it did not create a significant benefit to justify a full fee and cost award. Second argument is that the trial judge acted arbitrarily in focusing on the perceived self-interest of the petitioner in bringing the petition. Third, the trial judge made certain conclusions about the merits of the case, which we believe are not supported by the record. I acknowledge that Vice Chancellor Noble was put in a difficult position. He was not the judge who dealt with this case for 3+ years. He was not the judge who heard the trial, saw the witnesses, judged their credibility, and reached the conclusions that were ultimately reached in this matter. The trial judge acknowledged that he had something less than a full level of comfort in deciding this case, but nonetheless, Vice Chancellor Jacobs had been elevated to this court. He was dealt a certain hand of cards, and he had to deal with them, and then he made his decision.
What he did talk about, he quantified the $50,000 fee request at about 16% of the estate. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your
Honor. And let's suppose Mrs. Chadwick had lived and was still alive and was alive at the time of the hearing. You would have been saying something to the effect, although we've consumed 16% of the guardian's estate, she still has 84% of her estate to live on for the rest of her life, and but for our intervention, she would have had X percent. What would your argument have been, that she would have had nothing, or what part of the 84% would have been available to her, or not been available to her, but for your intervention?
Well, there's two aspects to that, as the court's aware. We had a guardian appointed to properly manage her affairs to be sure that she wasn't exploited and give away money and losing money. And two, we had generated a benefit, we believe, from having a temporary restraining order entered by the court that prohibited the son from taking 100% of the proceeds of her home. The home was a big issue at trial, something that had been addressed by many witnesses.
Well, now let's go back to the home. There's this 1984 deed that put it in joint name. So if the home had been sold, which is stopped, the son would have been entitled to half of the money anyway. Is that correct?
Arguably. Our position in the TRO request was that the son's name was added strictly as a convenience, not as a gift, not to make him a joint owner, not for the purpose of him being owner of one half of that property. The son himself acknowledged in his testimony, Mrs. Chadwick acknowledged, and others reiterated what had been said, that the son's name was purportedly added to the deed to keep her from being exploited or scammed by people, and that it also allegedly had some tax benefit that was never fully defined.
I know that argument was made, but if you look at the record in this case, where you have the deed in 1984, and then you have a will in 1994, the way I read the 1994 will, she leaves what she describes as her interest in the house to her granddaughter, her son to a car, and the residue to them equally. So a decade after the deed is in joint names, that looks like a testatrix who understands she has half of it to leave, and she's deciding to leave it to her granddaughter because her son's already on the deed. She's going to give her son some specific bequests and then divide it equally. All of which appears to me to be more consistent with a person that knows the implication of joint ownership in the deed than simply a convenience.
The evidence at trial indicated that this was a sore subject for many years, that Mrs. Chadwick was aware that her son's name was on the deed and she wanted his name taken off the deed. She told that to Adult Protective Service workers and others, that she wanted his name off the deed. He had declined or refused to take his name off the deed. Mrs. Chadwick had not, at that point in time, initiated any litigation to address that subject. That may have been something that would have been addressed by a court-appointed guardian had time permitted. But Mrs. Chadwick was steadfast in her belief that her son's name shouldn't be on the deed. She was aware it was on there, but we believe it was a trust situation as opposed to an attempt on her part to do estate planning to give the son a 50% interest in her home. And more importantly, the TRO prevented Mr. Kennedy from taking all of the proceeds of the home. He didn't want just 50% of the proceeds released to him when the home was sold on March 29 of 2003. He wanted all of those proceeds to acquire another property. I believe it was in Arizona. So we think, going back to the court's original question, that the answer to the trial judge is that we created a benefit in three ways. Filing the petition itself put a cloud on ongoing exploitation and transfers that were being made. Number two, the March 29, 2003 order prevented the son, Mr. Kennedy, from taking 100% of those proceeds and using them for his own benefit, not for the benefit of Mrs. Chadwick. And three.
Mm-hmm. Let me interrupt. You said that he wanted to take all the proceeds and use them to buy another house in Arizona?
He was talking about buying some property in Arizona.
And is the record clear that that was not for the benefit of the infirm person?
I think it is.
Does he maintain that he was doing that for his mother?
Not that I'm aware of. If that's in the record, I don't recall it.
So the son is saying that this house is going to be sold, and I'm going to take the money from selling the house, and I'm going to use it on something that has nothing to do with my mother's interests.
I suppose he would say, or he might have said, that his mother, who he had taken to live with him, was going to continue to live with him in some other jurisdiction, such as Arizona, and that by having a house and letting her live in that house, that was conferring some benefit to her. But I am not aware of him ever stating that his intention was to take that money and buy another property that would be in joint names with his mother or would be in his mother's sole name. He wanted to take 100% of those proceeds for his own use. The third issue, of course, with respect to the benefit conferred, and the most important one, is that this petition did result in the successful appointment of a neutral guardian of the property to handle her affairs. The court, I guess, was asking me what would happen with the 84% of the money. Certainly all that money would have been for the benefit of Helen Chadwick during the remainder of her lifetime, and all of the proceeds from the sale of the property, not just 50%. The petition was requesting that those proceeds be available to her grandmother, her grandmother's guardian, for her benefit for the rest of her lifetime.
So when Mark Jason Noble was doing these computations and he arrived at the 16%, he was using half of the money from the sale of the house, Mrs. Chadwick's half of the money, is that correct?
His conclusion was that the disabled person had an estate of approximately $300,000. That's in the record, that's in the petition that was originally filed in the court, and that $50,000 would be approximately 16% of what was originally represented to be her assets. That would include 100% of the value of the home.
So of the $300,000, you're saying that your efforts basically divested Mr. Kennedy of getting a check for the house, prevented him from getting it?
The TRO prevented Mr. Kennedy from taking the proceeds of sale and using them for his own benefit, and those total proceeds were approximately $116,000.
And so that's my question. If it's $116,000, is that $116,000 part of the $300,000 or only $58,000?
No, 116 is part of the 300. Again, the original petition represented the approximate assets of the disabled person, and including 100% of the value of the home, those assets totaled $300,000.
Was there ever a determination made that Mr. Kennedy wasn't entitled to $58,000?
No. No, that issue became moot by virtue of Mrs. Chadwick's death. But exactly what Mrs. Chadwick's estate consisted of at the time the guardian was appointed is something that we're not 100% certain of, because her assets were transferred out of Delaware, they were placed in banks in Maryland, and respondent and disabled person refused to provide that information. We assume that her estate was still approximately the same at the time that we were in trial in March and May of 2003. We have no reason to think otherwise. And again, the Vice Chancellor's estimate of her estate, 16%, is based on the original petition stating that her total estate, including her home, was worth about $300,000.
Well, is that consistent or inconsistent with, is this in the record about what was filed in Maryland in probate?
I'm sorry.
Is there an inventory in Maryland of?
Is there an inventory of the estate in Maryland? I assume that there is, but it's not in the record of this case, and I don't believe I have a copy of it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Didn't the vice chancellor, maybe not in so many words, but wasn't the gist of what he was saying that this was more a dispute between relatives over what was ultimately going to be a disposition of an estate than it was a guardianship matter? Or at least that those other aspects significantly impacted both the nature of the litigation and therefore the amount of time that the attorneys had to spend on it?
I think the vice chancellor speculated that this case, like others he has seen, impressed him as being more about the ultimate distribution of someone's estate rather than the best interest of a disabled person. I don't believe that's supported by the record of this particular case, but the vice chancellor speculated, I think, in his decision that many of these cases are maybe more about self-interest in estates than they are the best interest of the disabled person. We disagree with that. The petitioner disagrees that that was her motive in bringing this action. In the Griffiths case, a case that we cited in our brief, that's a case where the court appointed a guardian but decided that after some point, the case really was not about whether the person needed a guardian but who the guardian would be, and decided at that point the fees would be borne by the petitioners who are arguing over who the guardian should be, and we're no longer arguing over whether a guardian should be appointed. In this case, right to the very end, the argument was, should a guardian be appointed? And my client was not seeking her appointment, but rather the appointment of a neutral guardian. Mr. Kennedy, on the other hand, argued that no guardian was necessary, but if one was necessary, he should be the guardian.
And moreover, the infirm person was arguing that no guardian should be appointed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that's not all that common, is it?
I find it becoming more common.
Oh, really?
Frankly, I suppose in the big scheme of things, most of these cases are battles among siblings and other family members as to who should be the guardian, and it's not as common for a disabled person to be arguing that they don't need a guardian. But there are more and more cases where a disabled person's arguing that they don't need a guardian. But I believe, in this case and in many others, that really it's the other person who's pushing them to argue that they don't need a guardian, that this influence that was exerted upon Mrs. Chadwick by her son was really what prompted her to argue that she didn't need a guardian. And I think there's clear evidence in the record, Vice Chancellor Jacobs, in deciding the motion to dismiss, the motion for summary judgment, said something to the effect, it's clear to me that a strong case has been made out for undue influence, and there's a lot of confusion on the part of this disabled person. So notwithstanding the position taken, I'm not certain that was truly the disabled person's position. I think she was too confused to make a meaningful, intelligent decision.
You have about 2 minutes left, Mr. Ferrer. Do you want to reserve that?
I think I will reserve that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Amy Evans from Cross and Simon on behalf of John Kennedy. I would also note that below in the trial court that our firm represented Mrs. Chadwick. I have to say that I was only involved with this case since the appeal notice, and in reviewing the record, it scares me. Mrs. Moses files a guardianship petition seeking to have herself appointed guardian based on a physical disability of Mrs. Chadwick. And in support of that, they give an affidavit by Dr. Scheid, who says that the physical disability is elderly person with multiple medical problems, physical incapacity. Well, now, Mrs. Moses knew that there was no physical disability. Mrs. Chadwick wasn't comatose. She wasn't suffering from Alzheimer's. At best, she had some osteoporosis and heart disease, maybe some arthritis. So she was a physically capable woman taking care of herself, and that's exactly what she was doing. Dr. Scheid subsequently withdrew his assessment, saying, yes, she does have multiple medical problems, but she's not disabled in any way, and she can choose for herself what she wants a guardian. A month after the petition was filed, the guardian ad litem also said, There's no physical disability here. There's nothing physically wrong with her that she's incapacitated and can't make her own decisions. She has some confusion about her finances. Now, I have...
So that was somewhat euphemistic, wasn't it? I mean, the way I read her testimony, she would sign anything that her son or her granddaughter put in front of her. And she admitted that. She said, I don't know what it was, but if they asked me to sign it, I signed it. And she really didn't distinguish between her son or her granddaughter. She was willing to sign whatever either one of them asked her to sign. Isn't that a fair reading of the record?
I think, Your Honor, that it is a fair reading. She had a very trusting nature, and perhaps she should have been cynical. And I don't want to have to, you know, say out there that that's what we should all be, is cynical. She had family members that she trusted at the time. And that's what she, you know, she said, they're not going to harm me in any way. But in fact, it wasn't to her best interest, really, to do that. She was indeed relying on them, trusting them. And she should have been more cynical, perhaps. Well, to go to the confusion with the finances, I think there's a lot of people out there that have difficulties understanding
No one distinguished themselves with the conduct in this case. You know, the granddaughter would take her to sign a will or a codicil. The son would have her sign a will. They were doing things with her annuities. It seems by the end of her life, she was kind of tugged in two different directions.
And that's perhaps the case. That's the essence of this case here. It's between the granddaughter and the son. Now, Mrs. Chadwick's finances, they're not being stolen from her. She's not buying everything off of QVC. She's got a checking account. She's got savings. She's being taken care of. She's fine. There's no exploitation here. It's just where the estate's going to go when she's deceased. Now, Mrs. Moses, in January of 2000, takes Mrs. Chadwick and to Mr. Ganji, and Mrs. Chadwick changed her estate plan to favor June, Mrs. Moses. Well, 6 months later, the son takes Mrs. Chadwick to the bank, and Mrs. Chadwick changes her estate plan to favor the son. So it's just going back and forth between where the estate funds are going to go. She made a decision to change her estate plan.
Mr. Berry's argument focuses not on the estate, but on the sale of the house. Does the record support his assertion that if the house was sold, your client, Mr. Kennedy, would have used all of the proceeds to buy something in his name alone?
To my knowledge, it does not, Your Honor. I don't think it does.
So Mr. Berry has misrepresented the record to this court?
I hesitate to say misrepresent, but I feel that Mr. Kennedy was always acting in the best interest of Mrs. Chadwick, and that's what the record reflects.
But you would agree if he used all of the proceeds to buy a property in his name alone, then that money would no longer be available to Mrs. Chadwick?
Not as a benefit in that sense. That's correct, Your Honor. But as Justice Berger indicated, Mrs. Chadwick was being taken care of by Mr. Kennedy. She was living with him. And if they were going to Arizona, then Mrs. Chadwick would have been going to Arizona as well.
Well, what is your recollection as to what the record says about this Arizona venture and real estate in Arizona?
Your Honor, I have no strong recollection of the record. In fact, I'm not, Mr. Cross was the one involved in that particular aspect.
Well, it becomes somewhat critical in this appeal that we're hearing today. Because what we're hearing from Mr. Ferry is that $116,000 would have been used to buy a house in Mr. Kennedy's name in Arizona, and that by proceeding with the guardianship, $116,000 was really available for Mrs. Chadwick's care.
I'm not sure I'm exactly following. As far as the six...
Let me try it again. They're asserting that by having the guardianship established, they preserved $116,000 for the benefit of Mrs. Chadwick. And but for their intervention, your client, Mr. Kennedy, would have used the $116,000 to purchase a property in his name alone in Arizona.
I don't think that doesn't go to the guardianship aspect. That goes, I think, to their motion of the TRO, which is a separate action for a resulting trust.
Well, I understand that, and we all have read the record, and it looks like there's continuing litigation, but it started with getting control of the sale of the house and the proceeds, and then making sure that the proceeds were available for Mrs. Chadwick. And my question is that what happened? Is that what this record reflects, that they did intervene, and by getting control of the proceeds from the sale of the house, made it available to Mrs. Chadwick when, but for their intervention in all of the litigation, that never would have happened?
I don't see that. It's my recollection that they had separate interests. There were two people on the deed, and their interests would have been split. Mr. Kennedy would have taken his interest. Mrs. Chadwick would have had her interest.
And do you agree that the total was $116,000?
The sale price? I believe that's correct.
And so you just indicated, if we follow your logic, $58,000 would have gone to Mr. Kennedy, your client, $58,000 would have gone to Mrs. Chadwick. But what Mr. Ferry tells us is, because of his intervention, the entire $116,000 was available to Mr. Chadwick.
So an additional $58,000. But I don't see that that's what they got from the benefit, the intervention. The intervention was a TRO under circumstances in which Justice Jacobs was in Texas. And I think then Vice Chancellor Noble, who heard the hearing, heard testimony about this one-half interest in the property, mentioned in his order that, you know, he would have come to the conclusion that Mrs. Chadwick indeed wanted her son to have the half interest, that Mrs. Moses would not have been successful in reaching that resulting trust that she wanted. So I think you do have to look at that aspect as well in considering that. And if I may make a point as far as the 16% of the estate that was being mentioned, I don't think that did not include the fact that Mrs. Chadwick herself paid her own counsel fees. So if you add Mrs. Chadwick's counsel fees into that percentage, that increases significantly.
Is that in the record? Do we know what she paid?
It is not in the record what she paid. However, if the court would like, I can give an estimate of what that would have been. Mr. Ferry mentioned that it was at the insistence of this fund, and I can represent that. Mr. Kennedy paid his own fees to Mr. McLaughlin. Mrs. Chadwick paid the fees to our firm.
Well, if it's not in the record, it can't be a basis for our decision.
That's correct. I just thought I'd point something out there. If I may go on to, again, Mr. Ferry mentioned the reason that Mrs. Moses brought this guardianship. And as I look throughout the record, I keep seeing points of undue influence. And I think it's important to note that the influence is between the son and the daughter. It's not an outside third party which is coming in and saying, taking advantage of her, if you will, for lack of a better word.
I thought she was the granddaughter.
Mrs. Moses' granddaughter.
Right, you said son and daughter.
I'm sorry, I meant granddaughter.
Well, is it your contention that an elderly person who, at least arguably, is infirm shouldn't get or shouldn't need a guardian as long as the people who are trying to take advantage of her are her own family?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. But in this case, I don't see that they... But in this case, I don't see that that it in any way was harming her by changing her estate plans for her afterlife. Her present condition and circumstances, she was fine. She was being taken care of. Nothing was being depleted.
So what you're saying is that fortunately she was in reasonably good health and her life was going on and she didn't really need anybody, but what was happening that she was perhaps not handling well was that various members of her family were squabbling over what she was going to give away and at what point.
Exactly. That is exactly the point. And even if you read the briefing as well, and I pointed one out in the opening brief of Mr. Ferrier, perhaps it was an argument down below, says that the age circumstances surrounding Chadwick's situation, multiple powers of attorney and wills, the struggle, as it were, between the son and the granddaughter to have control of her affairs certainly warranted the filing of the guardianship petition. It's in part, I think it's unfair to say if the grant of a guardianship pursuant to a settlement is a benefit that the petitioner take full credit when she was part of the problem. That was the problem. And then she says, well, I was the problem, but give me my fees because I brought it to the court's attention and the court resolved it. There's no longer going to be, I'm no longer going to be, you know, haggling over where my estate's going to go with my with the son, Mr. Kennedy. So I think it really does come down to, in this case, the woman changed her mind on her estate plan. And I want to be, pardon me, I don't want to try and bring in myself, but, you know, she should be able to make up her own mind what she wants to do. And when we talk about undue influence, that's a will contest. That's not a guardianship. There was nothing mentally or physically wrong with Mrs. Chadwick. And Mrs. Moses knew this when she filed the petition, and the doctors continually said there's nothing mentally or physically wrong with this person. It's because of the family squabbling that somebody ought to come in and say, you know, well, stop. But that shouldn't reflect on the liberties of Mrs. Chadwick. Her liberty shouldn't be taken away because her family is squabbling. And as Solomon mentioned, it's more of a question, maybe she should have had a less trusting nature and been cynical towards her own family. Unless the court has any questions.
Thank you.
Just to clear up something with respect to the record about the value of the estate, I see now the pretrial stipulation that's reflected on A45 of the appendix to the appellant's opening brief reflects that at the time the pretrial stipulation was filed, the estimated assets of the disabled person were $320,000. So that replaces my earlier comments about the value of the estate being $300,000 at the time the petition was filed. At the time we were prepared to go to trial, it was $320,000. With respect to the amount of money that was paid into the court, that's reflected on A10 of the appendix to the appellant's opening brief, and that reflects in the docket entry of the Court of Chancery that the sum of $116,486.37 was deposited with the court being the total net proceeds from the sale. With respect to the record and the comments about what was going to happen with the proceeds, it was my client's fear that Mr. Kennedy, who had been controlling his mother, who had removed her from the state of Delaware and taken her to Maryland, who talked about moving her to Arizona, that he was going to take 100% of the proceeds of the sale. I don't know that there's any affirmative statement in the record that that's what he was going to do, but that was my client's fear, that he would take 100% of the proceeds. My client wanted all of the proceeds escrowed because she didn't believe that Mr. Kennedy validly owned a 50% interest in the property, that he was just holding that in some sort of trust position or convenience situation as opposed to being an owner, and she felt that all of the proceeds should be escrowed, and that is what the court agreed to do and entered an order that all of the proceeds be escrowed. If I can sum up with a brief amount of time remaining, the reasons that this court should reverse the Court of Chancery is that the trial court has given no reason or basis for deciding that only 10% of the fees and costs that were incurred should be awarded to the petitioner. The trial court found there's nothing wrong with the time spent, the hourly rate, et cetera, and that the fee was reasonable. The benefits were received as discussed. The length of the guardianship shouldn't be a factor. The motivation shouldn't be a factor. This decision sets a bad precedent and has a chilling effect for anyone else who would bring a petition to protect those that need protection.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The court will take this matter under advisement and we will adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart.